Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. I had the honor of sitting down with Billy Sheehan, and he went through the years that it took him to get to where he is today and all the bands that he was in. Plus, he's a fellow New Yorker like me, so he starts out the conversation on how he got involved with bass and who his local heroes were to look up to.
Well, I lived around the corner from a guy named Joe Hesse, H-E-S-S-E. And he mostly hung out with my older brother and sisters because I was a little kid. But he was a bass player, and he was a cool guy, and he had a beautiful babe girlfriend and a motorcycle, and still one of my dearest friends in the world, too. And I wanted to be kind of like Joe, and I could hear his bass at night. You know, I was a kid. I had to go to bed early, so the band would still be rehearsing around the corner, and I could hear, you know, how low frequencies travel. You hear a car's subwoofer from miles away. And so I could hear the bass and thought, wow, it'd be great to play that thing. And so I would go over, and I was a little kid, so they wouldn't always let me inside while they were rehearsing. But that was a time when there was just a million bands all over the place. There was always bands. As you'd walk down the street on a summer night, you'd hear one band rehearsing, and then go another block, and you'd hear another band. As you drive down the street at night, you could see drum sets set up in people's houses. And Joe's band was one of the most popular bands in Buffalo, and he was very well known. Millions of places to play, and all the bands were putting out their own records, and it was an explosion of music. Everything was about music. So one day I went over, and Joe let me pick up his bass, and I plucked it a few times with my finger and got a blister right away, and just thought it was really cool. And I saw the guitar players, and their guitars were little and had tiny little strings, and their amps were small, and he had a Fender Dual Showman with two cabinets, you know, it was this giant amp and everything, and I could hear it from miles away. So I thought, bass is really cool. I like to play that. So sure enough, time went on. I eventually acquired a bass and went on from there. One of the first bands I listened to was, of course, the Beatles were a huge influence. That started everything. But then when I started to get into other bands, the Yardbirds, Paul Samuel Smith, then, of course, Cream, Jack Bruce, Paul McCartney, as I already mentioned, Tim Bogert and the Vanilla Fudge. That was a huge influence on me, probably one of my biggest. And then I got into more instruments, listening to them and applying that to bass and learning millions of songs and then eventually getting in bands and going on my own.
Now, Billy is known for his fantastic two-hand tapping technique, very much like Eddie Van Halen, except on the bass. So he discusses what influenced him and how he kind of developed his technique and his tone. As a musician myself, I know that this is something that doesn't come right away. It develops after years and years of playing with bands, playing live in front of an audience.
More drummers, too. I just spent a day practicing all day today, and I was watching a zillion drummers and drummer things. And I watch when I'm performing live, it's the drummer. There's a guy I'm mostly watching. Any stringed or fretted instrument, a lot of cello, a lot of classical music, a lot of viola and violin, so with a lot of piano players, Oscar Peterson, a lot of classical music. So it wasn't just bass at all, music in general and all kinds of instruments. So I was a big fan of Ray Brown, Ron Carter, Miroslav Vitus, Neil Henning Orsted Pedersen, a lot of guys like that. I actually played a gig or two on an upright when I was very young. Interesting thing, I'm actually in the market now. I'm looking around for another stand-up bass. When you're at it, you're not really thinking about developing a technique. I think that's a big mistake. A lot of players now, they're trying to get a tone or trying to develop a technique. Now, you should be out playing. All that stuff comes later. I never tried to get a tone or tried to get a technique. I just had to learn 40 songs to play a night in a bar and then learn another 10 songs every 2 weeks to keep it fresh. Keep on learning more and more songs with band after band. And a lot of players now, when they jam, they don't know any songs, so they can't jam. What do you want to jam on? The key of A? How about a song? You know, so I'm lucky my generation, everybody I know that I grew up with knows at least 100 songs off the top of their head, sometimes 200 or 300. So I never thought about developing a technique. There was music I wanted to play. And after a while, I noticed there was some peculiarities to my playing that I didn't see in a lot of other players. Okay, well, maybe this is me. I saw Billy Gibbons play in 1974 or 5, no, something like that. Anyway, opening up for Alice Cooper on New Year's Eve, Buffalo, New York, he reached over and touched a note on the neck, and it made a note. Nobody had ever seen that before. I looked around with my friends. I looked at him like, holy cow, he literally reached over and touched the fretboard with his right hand. Never seen it before. No one ever had. But I first started doing it then. And then as I developed that on my own, I didn't know anyone else did it. But recordings of me from like 76 and 77 tapping and doing stuff like that. Then Ed Van Halen came out. Of course, he had doing it on guitar, the first I heard it on guitar. I thought it was the first I heard on guitar, but in fact, I really think I heard it on The Attack of the Giant Hogweed from Genesis. That whole intro is all tapped, and it's almost identical to Eruption, too. Yeah, Steve Hackett. Van Halen was called Genesis before they were called Van Halen. So I think Ed might have heard that and may have adapted some of that, because that's, if you listen to it, it's the same notes as Eruption. Kind of funny. Doesn't matter. Ed's awesome, and he popularized it and brought it to the world. So he gets all the credit in my book. So I was doing it myself. Who knows who came up with it first? It doesn't matter. He was a grandmaster and really introduced it to a lot of people. So that, about another, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10 techniques that I came up with probably aren't unique. Someone else somewhere does them, but I don't know of them. And I adapted a lot of piano techniques, a lot of string bow techniques, a lot of flamenco plucking techniques. So just because, like I said, I was glad to listen to a lot of other instruments rather than just bass and then be stuck just in that world, you know, though that's not such a bad thing. But I did want to kind of expand out and learn new things and get new challenges and enjoy it and see what more I could do.
Growing up in New York City, I knew Billy Sheehan and Talas. They had their own iconic label for themselves in New York by the early 80s, in the mid 80s. And I actually work with Phil Narro, who is one of the singers from Talas. So Billy explains the whole revelation of Talas.
No, I was kind of that was the band I grew up in, actually. We started right out of high school, went through a million permutations. There's probably about 10 or 12 versions of Talas. Some lasted longer than others. But we played, started as a copy band in the bar scene like everyone else. There's a couple bands prior to Talas. I played in a horn band, which played Chicago Blood, Sweat, and Tears stuff. A little jazzy there in some respects, because all horn players tend to lean that way. But it was great having my very first band in high school being a horn band, because those guys were really musically educated. Yeah, the guitar player and drummer were fantastic, too. So we had a really excellent band right while we were in high school. So we learned a lot from that. But eventually it permutated into Talas, and we were just a straight up rock band for years and years and years and years. And we played every kind of gig you could imagine. We played 21 nights in a row one time. We did 3 full shows in one day once. Set up in the morning, tore down, set up in the afternoon, tear down, set up in the evening, and tore down. And so we just played hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows. And that is why I am at where I'm at today. It's just the years of clubs. It's like a difference between a club fighter and a gym fighter. A club fighter is used to being up against every situation you could imagine, and they become so experienced that whatever punch you throw at them, they've already had it thrown at them 20 times. May not be nearly as glamorous as a nice gym, clean floors and a shower, but fighting in the sweaty club, that's how guys really learn how to fight. It's the same thing with music. You know, you're in a sweaty, horrible club, usually with no dressing room at all, back with your friends, and you step off the stage into your friends and hang out with them until the next set started, and you step up from the audience onto the stage and play another hour. Very, very connected to the audience, playing great music by great bands, which really helps you later to write songs and understand how great bands function. When you're playing Zeppelin, The Who, and The Stones, and The Beatles, and Jethro Tull, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Three Dog Night, and Grand Funk Railroad, and all those bands we played, and a million more. When it comes time to write, you've got some vocabulary, you know, how to put a chorus after a verse. And it's the same thing the Beatles did, the same thing Van Halen did, the same thing AC/DC did, the same thing every great band did. Was you learn by imitating others. Great artists, really, even painters or photographers, you learn by imitating others, and then you start to get your own voice. And that's what happened. That's when we started writing a couple songs. We'd clear the dance floor off, and the club owner would get mad, so we'd go back to playing copy tunes. And then eventually we got good enough at it that some of the songs we wrote, people started liking. Trial and error, and we were great in a great situation. We could get up every night and perform the songs we wrote and see how they went over. And if they didn't go over, what we needed to change to make them go over. Not only learning songwriting, you're learning performance and production as well, and arrangements as well. So I just wish this generation of musicians had that. But every generation has something that is theirs and will make them unique and will make them different. Playing in front of indifferent audiences really forces you to have to figure out a way to get their attention. And after a while, you know, a lot of showmanship evolves and your ability to talk to the audience and then also start talking with the audience on the break and find out what they like and what they don't like and fine-tuning your playing and your set and your sound and your songs to that. It's always an essential thing. You're basically doing market research before you knew that's what it was called. We received a lot of criticism initially, you know, a lot of negatives, but way more positives. And we were drawing people. So, you know, out of 1,000 people, you know, 3 of them hated it. That's less than 1%. So you're in pretty good shape there statistically. So, and we would pack out every club, and we were pretty soon through the biggest draw in Buffalo and then the biggest draw in Western New York. And then we started spreading out to New York City and Boston and Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Toronto and Detroit, you name it. We started anything within a 4-hour drive, then a 6-hour drive, then a 10 or a 12-hour drive was within striking distance for us. So we hit the whole Northeast eventually and became quite popular, if I dare say, in that even to this day, I get emails about Talis just about every day. Yeah, Lemoore is the famous. We used to play there all the time. I remember walking down the street in New York City not too long ago, people, hey, Talis, and about 3 or 4 guys are yelling out Talis. And there's a picture of the first rehearsal of Dream Theater, and Mike Portnoy is wearing a Talis shirt. They used to come see us play, and it was kind of interesting that here we are playing together after all these years. At the time, it was rough. It was tough. We were in a van, but you know, we were young, and we could put up with that, so it was no trouble. And again, it was just incredible training ground. So, you know, you get to the point where you can handle anything. Mostly all just rock. We threw a few fusion things in there. We played, I jammed with my friends with some fusion things, but it was mostly, Talis was a rock band. We threw in Schizoid Man by King Crimson and a couple of, I think we did Red or some other King Crimson song at one point in the band. And I was learning a lot of Return to Forever songs and King Crimson and Genesis and all the early original prog stuff was really cool. And then I was way into it. Other than that, it was mostly straight up rock. And that's why a lot of bass players, when they start to play more stuff, they go into fusion jazz, where I stuck with rock, just more what I like. I enjoy listening to some jazz, but fusion stuff is cool. But as a great guitarist friend of mine said to me one time, fusion is mostly woman-repellent music. When Mr. Big opened up for Rush on their Presto tour, they made a joke. It's the first time they'd seen girls in the first 10 rows of the audience in years. Funny. Yeah, so I'm mostly stuck with rock. Like I said, classical is probably my second most favorite music, and then fusion and jazz after that. But I do love being challenged by music that's difficult to play and stuff also that I'm not necessarily into, but I know it's amazing. Stuff I listen to, but I know it's musically unbelievable. So I would try to learn it or learn some of it just to give me a little bit more vocabulary. Playing with Dennis Chambers changed my life. That's what I mean before about I'm more about drummers than guitarists, you know, and he's the man. He's the best musician I know, the best musician I've ever played with. And he's on any instrument. He changed my life all for the better. He's incredible. Wonderful guy too. I learned a lot from him, and I'm still learning.
Billy spoke about how he got the David Lee Roth gig with Steve Vai, and also how he wound up forming his solo gig with Mr. Big, which had a lot of number one hits. But the Roth gig was really the breaking point for all those cats.
Yeah, Talis opened for Van Halen in 1980. We did about 30 shows with them, and I got to know Eddie a little bit more than Dave, but I knew Dave and Michael and Alex as well. And then as time went on, I would go see the band when they'd come through town or when I was in one of their cities and go backstage and say hello. And eventually, to make a long story short, summer of 85, I didn't know Dave quit, but his office called my office and you want to have a meeting with me about something. Sure enough, when I got to LA, I found out what the meeting was about, and Dave wanted to start a band. So I said, sure. And his initial choice for guitar was Steve Stevens, but Steve was busy with Billy Idol. So I told Dave, I know another Steve, because Steve Vai was also on the same label as Talas, Relativity Records. So I brought Steve in, and Steve, supreme talent, of course, undeniably the perfect man for the gig. And then we went off on Greg Bissonette, and there we went. Well, yeah, we rehearsed and wrote in Dave's basement of his house, and eventually put the record together, recorded in wintertime, and came out, I think, on the 4th of July of summer of 86. There we were. Then we were out on tour, and all hell broke loose. It was a great, amazing adventure, an incredible time. Well, I left Dave and wanted to start a band, and I already knew Paul Gilbert, and I kind of knew Pat Torpy, too. And so I got together with them and said, you know, what do you guys think? And I was in touch with Ted Templeman, also the Van Halen producer, the Eat 'Em and Smile producer. And, you know, he was on my side. I said, sure, you know, let's work together and maybe make something happen. So I started looking around for singers. I found Eric in San Francisco. Listened to some of his demos, sounded great. So I went up to San Francisco, had a meeting with him. And a guy that I had been working with as a manager, Herbie Herbert, who was the legendary, one of the founding fathers of the music business, as we know. So I thought, well, Herbie as a manager is unstoppable, and Eric's voice is as good as it gets. So I went down to L.A. and told Paul and Pat, okay, I think I got a singer. I got us all together in a room, and we started churning out songs. Herbie cut us some amazing deals, got us a record deal, got us tours, got us the Rush tour, got us Bryan Adams tour, got us Scorpions tour, got us all kinds of stuff, got us in Japan, got us all over Europe. Second record came out, and bang, we had a number one single.
Now, I've always been a real big fan of Billy's solo career. I really like his albums. I love that it's like bass in your face and just concentrating on bass instrumental songs. So I was actually anxious to see when he's going into studio and to give us some more delightful music.
I probably will do one relatively soon. I've got some ideas already for... I probably already have too much material because I'm always writing. So I had to pare it down to the stuff I like the best. But it's going to be probably a bass-heavy record, more like wild, crazy playing as opposed to song-oriented. So most of my solo records have been about songs and singing, where I'd like to do one that's just kind of completely out of control. I did my first and second solo records on that, Compression and Cosmic Troubadour, and then I did another one after that, a record called Holy Cow, which was a pretty cool situation. Had Billy Gibbons came over to my house, played a solo on my little record. So one of the high points of my life, the guy who I got hammer on from came over to my house, and he's one of the most wonderful guys I know. And just I love his playing so much. And I'm a huge ZZ Top fan forever. And it was just one of the greatest honors of my life. It was wonderful. Playing a lot of different situations, as you probably well know. I have Niacin, which is relatively inactive right now, but who knows? We'll get an opportunity where our schedules align. Niacin, Winery Dog is my favorite band. Mr. Big, of course. We're not sure about the future of that, but we still have some more shows to do. And then now I'm out with Sons of Apollo, which is doing really great. And a couple other little projects as well. Right now, one band really, especially when I was with Mr. Big, because of Pat's health problems, we couldn't really go out and tour constantly, you know, and I got to be playing live. It's important for my hands and my state of mind. I got to be playing. I got to be in good shape as a player. And the only way you can do that is by being up on stage, playing. So I do get into other bands just so I can have the opportunity to have a lot of shows happening to keep my hands in shape. So I did a long run with Steve Vai, too. That was great because we wasn't much vocals in the band at all, so we would play like zillions of shows. You didn't have to worry about anyone's voice blowing out, so we played just so many shows. It was crazy. But when there's vocals, especially with a lead vocalist handling the lion's share of everything, it's you got to pace yourself a little differently. But right now, you know, I'm involved in about four or five bands and do some solo stuff at some point live, too. And it's good. I'm grateful to have all that. could only do one tour of one band at a time, or otherwise I'm not sure how I'd do that. Though there is one slight overlap. We're doing a Mr. Big show and a Sons of Apollo show on the same festival the same day. So I'm going to have to get done with one band, towel on, and run over to another stage. So I'm going to hire a video guy to document my day that day, because it should be pretty crazy.
There he is, Billy Sheehan. He is the true Renaissance man of bass. He's in so many different projects, and he balances them all so well. And he fits them all so well, and he's just such a fantastic bass player. So here he is. Suspense is killing me. man, I had to play that. That's Black Hawk featuring Billy Sheehan and myself from Guitars for Wounded Warriors. That's Brian Tarquin and Heavy Friends. Before that was Mean Streets, which of course is a great cover by Billy Sheehan and Niacin of that Van Halen classic album, Fair Warning.